listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
The cultural and economic environment is ever-changing, evolving. Over the last decade, we've seen bookstores closing, newspapers struggling to stay afloat. Thanks to laptops and cheap internet, as Scott Timberg observes in his astute new book, Culture Crash: The Killing of the Creative Class, we're now living in a world of the free agent. We're all citizens of Freelance Nation. Welcome to the new gig economy. Yes, you love Instagram, but what does that mean for Kodak, which once employed 140,000 people and supported an entire region of upstate New York? Instagram, which bought Kodak, has 13 full-time employees. What happened to all those middle-class jobs? Remember when working hard was touted as the secret to success? As Barbara Ehrenreich pointed out in her classic book, Nickel and Dimed, you can work hard in this country and still find yourself sinking into poverty and debt. We've convened a panel of arts professionals to explore this altered landscape, what the musician Richard Thompson calls the darker consequences of the digital age, and to discuss the thesis of Scott's new book, that when artists and artisans can't make a living, the health of America's culture is at risk. What are the new creative models for economic survival and livelihood for artists and cultural workers and others? Let's meet our panel. Scott Timberg is a Los Angeles-based culture writer, contributing writer for Salon, and former LA Times arts reporter who's contributed to the New York Times, GQ, and The Hollywood Reporter. He's also co-edited with Dana Gioia the anthology, The Misread City, New Literary Los Angeles. Scott also runs Art Journal's Culture Crash blog. Sitting next to him is Barbara Bester, a principal of Bester Architecture and the executive director of Woodby University's Julius Shulman Institute. Barbara is also the author of Bohemian Modern, Living in Silver Lake. At the end is John McRae, a founding member of the band Cake, for which he is lead vocalist, primary writer, and lyricist, in addition to playing rhythm, acoustic guitar, piano, and vibraslap. He and the rest of the band have produced all of their albums. John is also a founding member of the Content Creator Coalition Organization, an artist-run nonprofit advocacy group representing all creators in the digital landscape. And our moderator tonight is Sasha Anawalt, director of USC Annenberg Arts Journalism Programs, including the master's degree in specialized journalism. Sasha is the author of the best-selling cultural biography, The Joffrey Ballet, Robert Joffrey and the Making of an American Dance Company. Let's give a warm, aloud welcome to our Culture Crash panelists.
Thank you, Maureen, and welcome everybody tonight. We're here, you know, I heard that this talk sold out really quickly. I was told something like 45 minutes, but that's probably an exaggeration, which is really interesting because tonight is the night that this book is born. It's officially published today. And so, congratulations.
Thank you, Sasha. Appreciate it.
It also probably means that most of you haven't read it yet. And so, you know, aside from the fact that these esteemed people are on this panel, I think that there's something going on in this title that appeals to people. And it's you know, I mean, culture crash. Doesn't sound very, you know, promising. Most crashes have damage involved and reasons for happening. And we go on to say the killing of the creative class. The killing. Killing has a resonance, particularly, I think, this week because of what was going on.
Yeah, literal killing.
Literal killing.
Absolutely. much worse than what we're going
through. So we're thinking about that, the killing of the creative class is economic. And so, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, we are here with you, and we have this one moment in which what Scott argues in his book is that the 1%, which is really Instagram and Netflix and Amazon and Google and these internet giants, Facebook and YouTube, are the 1% who are clobbering the artists and who are making a lot of money off of the artist. He also documents really the decline of the ability for the artist to make a living full time. And you know how changed the life is for artists. And really, Scott, you start with your own. And I would like, Scott is a journalist. I put him in this creative class. He's also an author. So you start your book with losing your job.
Yeah.
And your home.
Yeah.
And
a lot of fun. Don't recommend it.
and this was, so what I really, really like is for you to talk about, you know, what is the evidence that you found as a journalist of the crashing of this creative culture, of this culture? And why did you write this book, and how did it all started?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, I just want to thank everybody for your interest in this book. Seeing the size of this audience almost makes me happy enough to balance out the despair I felt writing it. So thank you very much for coming, giving a damn about the subject. And, you know, I start out the book talking about, you know, some of the hell I went through and the 2008 recession and the years that followed. But really, I wrote the book... you know, as my wife will vouch, I'm only moderately interesting. The reason this was worth doing is there were a lot of people besides me. I knew some of them. I had friends and neighbors. I had colleagues at the paper. I had people in my neighborhood. There were people I knew who, I mean, I write about authors and musicians and artists and so on for a living. I've been doing it for 20 some years. So there are a lot of people I know moderately well, pretty well at all levels. And I knew it wasn't just me. It didn't necessarily give me, you know, great solace to know that the couple down the street who I adored were, you know, who were animators, were splitting up because they had lost their job and their marriage was being ground into dust. I mean, I was seeing this happening all around me. I had friends at magazines who would say, oh man, I'm really sorry you lost your job. I'm going to give you, you know, let me throw you a piece to work on. And then he calls me next week and says, I just got canned too. I don't know how I'm going to hold on to my apartment. You know, this was happening everywhere. I had architect friends, you know, all over the place. So I was surprised by that. I mean, I don't think, especially those of us who take the sort of risk-averse path to become a journalist and really think that it's going to be a boom-bust kind of thing. It seemed like kind of one of the safer, you know, precincts. But I saw it happening all over the place. I was confused. I was wondering what the hell happened. And as I saw this in, you know, my own life, the people I knew, I wondered, why the hell are we not hearing anything about this? You know, I wasn't reading about it. I wasn't hearing radio on it. I knew that, you know, we all knew that the economy was bad. We were hearing about the banks. We were hearing about the government bailing out the banks. We weren't hearing about what was happening to creative folk. And we also sure as hell weren't hearing any calls to save them. You know, Detroit got bailed out. The banks got bailed out with our tax money, I should add. There was no talk about saving, you know, newspapers, photographers, musicians, authors, publishing folk, etc. So I started asking myself a bunch of questions, which is, I guess, the way most journalists, a lot of writers work. And as I got into this, I realized that it wasn't just about, you know, unemployment or an economic thing, and it wasn't just about the internet. You know, the recession had sort of underlined some tensions that went back a few decades. I mean, you know, inequality, the sort of galloping of inequality goes back to about the 70s when that sort of mid-century consensus broke down. So I started to realize as I thought about this and talked to people who I trusted, started to see there were lots of dimensions to it, and I wanted to bring it together. I knew that musicians had been through this, the Napster and the piracy waves that had sort of ravaged especially rock musicians. I knew some of that. I never thought that had that much to do with me. Suddenly I realized it did. You know, my business going through this too. A friend of mine who was a painter who lived in Venice Beach, which is obviously a neighborhood with a sort of artistic legacy. He was having the same problems. He couldn't sell landscape, you know, paintings anymore, so his family was going to probably have to leave their house as well. I started to see that we were kind of all in the same boat. I never really thought of it that way. So again, I just asked myself, I asked myself and people I knew as many questions as I could to figure out what the hell had gone on, and again, why we weren't hearing about it anywhere. And I sought out people who I thought knew more than I did, a number of sources like John, who's a musician, who had seen this process, you know, hit him and his colleagues a few years earlier. John sought me out, and there were other people who found me, gave me more people to talk to. So I probably interviewed about 100 people. Some of them didn't end up in the book, but they all kind of deepened my understanding. I probably read about 100 books, you know, the culture, sort of the creative class and culture makers going back to Greece and Rome, and before. I wanted to know how people had made a living over history and even into prehistory, and how the mainstream of society had viewed artists and musicians and dancers and so on. And it was fascinating, and I wanted to figure out, again, how we got into this mess and how we could get out of it. Those were the big questions I asked myself and everybody I spoke to.
So you interviewed John and you interviewed Barbara about, you know, how did you get into this mess? Or I think the more interesting question with I'm going to start with John and we're headed for you, Barbara. But John, you have this organization and you really believe that the case has to be made, that artists have been not treated very well, that, you know, taking the opportunity to say, hey, it would be great to get paid every once in a while is a really important thing to do. Can you tell your story and your position?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Scott.
My pleasure, man.
I'm more concerned about journalism than I am about music.
Huh, interesting.
You know, it's one of the...
I'm glad somebody gives a shit about it. I appreciate it. I don't hear that very often.
Well, it's more fundamental in some ways to a functioning, working democracy, government.
Yeah.
There's certainly been a contraction. I've certainly seen a lot of my friends have to make difficult choices, and it's difficult because we've inherited the legacy, I think, from the baby boom sort of 60s, 70s, sort of excessive, expansive generations of music where musicians are throwing television sets out of hotel room windows. And so there's a sense of us being a very decadent group of people, very sort of deserving of suffering, and maybe suffering helps our work. And so we're not supposed to say, excuse me, this isn't working, this isn't sustainable. But it's sad for me to see, a friend of mine who I think is a really important songwriter, probably a songwriter that most of people in this room have heard of and enjoy, studying to become a bricklayer late in his life. And so... I don't know if he wants me talking about him, so I'm going to not say who he is. But the point is that it seems, at a very fundamental level, a misallocation of resources, of songwriting resources. This guy is a really great songwriter. And I feel, and then there's, there may be ethical concerns as well, that there's a supply chain that where for-profit businesses are making money and not paying, the artists are the only one in that supply chain not getting paid for the monetization of that music. So, and I think that's the point at which, for me, it dawned on me that, well, I know I'm not supposed to care about money culturally, but if there's a BMW ad in front of my song and I'm not getting anything, I studiously avoided, car ads for decades, and only to sort of have them foisted upon me. It was the juncture at which I decided that something had to be done, and for artists, I think it's there's a fundamental sort of fetishizing of individuality and strident assertion of separateness, and yeah, the artist is a satellite orbiting the earth, completely rootless from mm-hmm. everything that's happened before. And there's a sense of like, we're not supposed to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, let alone organize.
And has the song Kumbaya been mentioned once in the last 20 years and not been like a joke of how stupid it is to even suggest? I mean, it's funny how quickly that became sort of, anyway, sorry
right.
to interrupt.
Which was maybe the that's a dead giveaway for what's happening culturally.
Right, right, you know, yeah.
But I.
It's seen as corny to have any kind of unity at all. It's like, oh, that's just some silly 60s lefty thing.
Right, but increasingly I realize that it's arrogant for artists to think that somehow, because we're creative and special somehow, maybe, that capitalism is going to give us a free pass. And that that it's nothing personal, but corporations the size of nation states, I have no business trying to negotiate with a corporation that big. And I need a collective voice, and I need to join with other artists. And maybe other artists of different mediums, maybe cartoonists and filmmakers and people from all over the place who are currently unrepresented need to find some sort of collective leverage, some sort of aggregation of power. So for me, it's we were sort of naive and perhaps arrogant not to do this. I'm glad that people are starting to think about it. But this is something we should have done 60 years ago, do the same thing a lot of garbage men and school teachers have done, you know. I think it's fundamental in the current sort of market economy in which we operate, so.
Yeah,
so we're,
yeah.
We're also talking generationally in a sense, and one mm-hmm. of the things that Scott, you do in your book is to talk about the history and the origins of what does it mean to be an artist? Who is an artist? What is an artist? And the generation from which both all three of you come is one in which the original voice is prized. The right. isolation and working alone in your garret making work is the thing to do. What the internet has done, arguably, is to say, hey, everybody collaborate, team up, get together. Originality, everyone can make something. What are we talking about? So there's a sort of been a dilution of the old idea of what an artist is. I don't know if you...
Why don't you jump in
with your... She's an incredible architect.
Yeah. No, I think that the positive spin on that generally is the idea of the democratization of access. Like, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. someone can make a film on their iPhone and put it out there, and that I do think is a huge kind of boon from technology. That I think all of us probably acknowledge that. What's interesting though is how you sort of differentiate qualitatively what's, you know, good and what's not good, and that's sort of where this whole role of the journalist, the critic, the curator, et cetera, right. comes in. And the kind of questions about like what is elitist, what is not elitist, sort of come into play I guess one of the things that I got out of one of the chapters of Scott's book that I really loved was about how, in a sense, a lot of big art movements have come out of different communities, like a particular mm-hmm. community in a particular place. I think you have something about Austin, Texas, and the 80s, and Cambridge, and modern poetry, and the 50s, stuff like that. And I guess my point of view as a sort of urbanist / architect and maybe a Los Angeles-centric person these days is that's, I think, about to become a really huge issue for us here. And I think that is sort of what your book starts to point at. We've heard a lot about it in New York City, where everybody's sort of priced out of living in New York City. Then there's Brooklyn, and now you can't afford to live in Brooklyn, so I don't really know what the next burg is. But, you know, in L.A., we've had Curbed L.A. has been a very good way of telling us all very acutely, statistically, what is changing, economically, and rents very different. And I think that as someone who, you know, kind of looks proudly on the L.A. school, like L.A. in the 60s, L.A. in the 70s and 80s, and architecturally, you know, there's just been this incredible amount of stuff coming out of not necessarily typical patronage-type architectural situations, like a lot of kind of low-budget, interesting work. It's you know, when I am a little nervous about what happens where the development and the densification is driven largely by developers and not so much by kind of, you know, the creative classes. That, I think, is, for me, like one of the hugest issues, like what will this city look like, and also will it be hospitable to different kinds of cultural, you know, not aggregators, that's like an internet word, but the, you know, kind of accumulation of people doing a particular thing, like CalArts, you know, created such an amazing moment and continuing moment in the fine arts. Musically, we all know all this amazing stuff, but so I kind of get nervous from a city person, as a architect and sort of lover of the city and the city life and its vibrancy. Like, how does that, where's that going to come out?
You know, Sasha, you asked me, I kind of jumped ahead. Can I complete my answer to your question with something?
So I think
if you didn't say it explicitly, what you and perhaps some other people in the audience are thinking is, you know, I saw a movie last week I really liked, or, you know, the Mad Men season is coming up, or the D'Angelo record is really good. You know, all these things are, you know, Boyhood, the Linklater movie just won. So you're saying, what cultural crisis, Timber? You know, what's really wrong? It seems like everything is going great. You know, the economy is finally improving, blah, blah. So here's just a few things that I use as evidence. And I'm guessing, by the way, that most of the people in this room are here because they've seen it happen, either themselves, somebody they know, somebody they care about. But let me just throw some numbers out. So Barbara's an architect. So jobs in architect fell by almost 30% in the 3 years after 2008. Newspapers cut 40,000 jobs in the 3 years after 2008. Those have they've continued to shed jobs since then. Since the mid-90s, we've added 60 million people to the U.S. population. The number of independent bookstores in this country are half of what they were back then in a smaller nation. Nashville has lost 80% of its songwriters since the year 2000. Hollywood studio musicians saw their income cut in half from 2007 to 2014. This is of interest only to me and a handful, and Sasha and a handful of other people, but since 2000, nearly 80% of journalists covering the arts for print have lost their jobs. So it's not like it's just one little place geographically. It's not just one genre. It's not one kind of person. It's not highbrow. It's not lowbrow. It's all over the place. But when, you know, somebody like, say, Amanda Palmer or some kind of internet sensation discovers how to do this, you know, you hear nothing, you know, you hear about nothing but that. You know, there's sort of the Horatio Alger stories of the New Gilded Age. This other stuff you probably have not heard nearly enough about. Again, that's part of the reason why I wanted to write this. And these things are real for those of us who've been through them. They will affect you whether you're directly connected to it or not. And if you know, the dates I'm using, it's not just the recession, it's not just any one thing. It's a series of waves that have crashed. They're all sort of overlapping, so they're hard to interpret, but they all add up to this sort of hollowing out of the broad creative class that I was interested in.
I just wanted to add, I think it's confusing because people see what the most visible members of the creative class are the superstars.
Yeah, celebrities. Yeah.
Those images are foisted at us all the time of this, you know, top, you know, tenth of the 1%.
Right.
And I think that that's a misrepresentation. Most of the creative class are lower middle class. You know.
Yeah.
Most of them, I find their work more interesting than that top 1%. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you are also working, Barbara, with, you're talking about patronage and working with people and building their private homes, but also doing a lot of commercial work too. What are you seeing and how, you know, I think you have a kind of positive grasp on life and your work.
I'm probably the Pollyanna of the panel.
Yeah.
True, yes.
So, because the statistics that you just read are humongously depressing, right? But the fact of the matter is people are not stopping being creative and people are not stopping doing work and buildings are being built and books are being written. One just is today. So tell me your turning point and what you're doing in your work and your life and what's happening in architecture.
200
big
words
ones.
Or less,
okay,
yeah.
Well.
I think one of the things that we talked about before, which is that as someone who's a bit of an academic, and I teach graduate students looking at architecture as a career, and I also have worked a lot with these companies that employ a lot of younger folk in the millennial category, I guess. Is the idea of work as home, kind of? I mean, that I don't know if that's so much the case for my students, but it's certainly in our work as you get into this new economy where you might be working a 16-hour day instead of a 10-hour day or 8-hour day, the whole nature of the workplace changes. And it can be very hilarious in the kind of Silicon Valley way, and I think John has a good story about that, but, you know, the sort of overly ridiculousness, but a lot of it really is this idea that if you're going to be there all that time anyhow, why pretend, don't put people in cubicles, kind of create these other interior cities. Now, where that stands in a sort of political spectrum, or, you know, in terms of what Scott's talking about, is a different category, I guess, from what I would address as a designer, is trying to make these sort of community cities that function in a way that make people feel included and room for extroverts and introverts and all this kind of different stuff. Like, you're really trying to provide that space because the public space may well not be providing it, nor might those people be in the public space that much because of the nature of
the work. Public space is getting killed off increasingly.
Kinda, yeah, there's not a lot. So a lot of our commercial projects end up essentially, they perform a certain amount of de facto public space function. Like, there's sometimes the Agora would maybe be a function, or sort of the Viennese coffee shop, you know, whether or not people are fomenting revolution in it. Depends on the,
you know. Speaking of not fomenting revolution, I wonder if I could just jump in and talking about campuses where people live, work. I would just like, John talks about visiting one of these sort of tech utopias once, and it was an important turning point for you realizing that you had to change your life. Could you tell us a little about that visit where your band played? I think it was a Google campus, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was still sort of taking it all in, as it were, and not necessarily Pollyanna-ish, but just sort of trying to navigate and on the fence generally. And we were invited to play at the Google campus, a show during the daytime show, and for a Halloween event. And you know, I've never felt so much like I was in ancient Rome during the height of their power. There were, you know, statues by famous sculptors everywhere, organic gardens on rolling hills, and free cappuccinos for everyone, free sushi everywhere, excellent Mexican food. They had trapeze artists climbing around everywhere.
Sort of sounds like
they had brought giant, like, pumpkins the size of VW buses, and they were carving them up with knives, and craftspeople were making everything beautiful, and they had flown in Hollywood makeup artists to make up all of their employees to look like zombies, which I thought was a little bit poignant. And
you realize this is where all my songwriting royalties have gone, right?
Yeah, so what? So
this
what
is why my bandmates and I are not getting paid.
Well,
this is where it's gone.
What I saw was a massive transference of wealth from people that make stuff over to people that distribute stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And, you know, most of Google's money is advertising money, and they advertise on just about anything and everything. And that's a great business model for them, and that's why they're fighting so hard for net neutrality, which I believe in. But it's part of their deal, and it's also why they're they have an investment in the evisceration of value of content. And for me, philosophically, I think we should claim our public spaces. We should have our own public spaces that are not controlled by corporate interests. We can't trust the market to look out for quality of life. We've learned that pretty well, I think. And for me, I think I think a lot of us have bought into an idea that markets are magical, and that somehow quality of life will generally be increased, but it's certainly not the case. And I don't think all of the books ever written on the planet Earth have any business being anywhere but in the public space. Why is that being even suggested that that should be controlled by a private corporation? So anyway, that's where I was coming from. And looking at the massive transfers of wealth, it made me grumpy, and that's why I'm here. Well,
I think that reminds me of the sort of issue we were talking about before, which is the, like, as a sort of steadfastly Gen X person, I guess, the one of the kind of really lovely novels of that period, which was also very optimistic and maybe tied into some of the kind of early hopes for the internet, was the Douglas Copeland, the author of Generation X, his book Microsurfs, which is like a kind of not a novel that takes place in Silicon Valley in the early days, but is generally a sort of very sort of humanist pro, this is going to be a good thing, versus, say, Dave Eagers, you know, later next generation main writer, the Circle, which I read recently. I was like, oh yeah, well, these are, you know, the utopian, the dystopic are very much present and constantly at battle in terms of how we think about this, our relationship to the internet. And I don't think anybody knows yet how this is all going to settle down. I mean, it certainly seems like the corporations are much better at monetizing aspects of internet stuff than any individuals, but it's a kind of how we narrativize it, I think, is a really interesting process. I think your book then is kind of another kind of a narrative, like
I hope so.
Critical.
Yeah. Right.
But I think we deserve public spaces, and not everything should be stamped with a corporate logo and our coliseums. I mean, do we really need an amphitheater to be called Sleep Train Amphitheater? don't we deserve better than that?
You remember how in David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, how the years are named after consumer products, like adult diapers and things like that. Instead of 2016, it's named for like an undergarment, you know, because the corporations have just conquered everything. You know, that's sometimes where I feel we're going.
But that is also a position that we all share as, you know, children of the 80s. I mean, that we've always been critical of that, I think. Like that, I think, is sort of, you know, like the sort of punk aspect of your book as a critique is inherently a distrust, which I agree with. And I certainly was not advocating that public space should be privatized, more that because of where I came from anyhow in the 80s, we were always looking for places to do architecture that were essentially in between space, you know, like under the freeway, the alleyway, like under, because there wasn't anything else getting built that wasn't a giant corporate postmodern logo. It was very, you had to be very sort of strategic and you know, sort of situationist about how you did it. So I guess what I would say that in practice that is actually how it has ended up kind of going for me, but it certainly is not public space, who needs it? I think in places that have a lot of good public space, it's incredibly active and used, and how LA like treats the LA River will be a really interesting
right. Yeah.
How is this going to turn out?
Yeah.
Maybe it'll get sponsored by Google. I don't know.
Maybe we don't need Google. Maybe we can sponsor ourselves. Mm-hmm. Maybe instead of bashing government all the time, we can think about improving government and letting people who are government workers have pride and pay them more.
But John, we've come out of 40 years since Reagan came in where we've been told that government is the problem, you know, so why should people think otherwise? You know, the idea that there's a public good and that there's a society, Margaret Thatcher told us there was no such thing as society, we've been harangued for three decades that these are evil things, that they're welfare queens, you know, and it's just destroyed people's faith that they can do something better. I agree with you. We need to recover some sense of possibility. You know, people say that my book is depressing. I mean, some of the statistics are, but I think we need to recognize the problem and move into the future. And it does require, if not optimism, because a lot of blind optimism has gotten us into bad things. The economic collapse, these wars we've had, partly comes from this stupid, uncritical optimism that says it'll all work out if we just invade or deregulate or whatever. But we need at least some sense that things can get better, and we need the state and the public sphere to be part of that. Without it, if we have Wall Street and their lobbyists and these tech companies in the on the West Coast, we, the creative class, will get absolutely crushed if we're up against them as individuals. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and the you mentioned the LA River. And for me, that's a poignant sort of metaphor for a lot of what's happening generally. I would just had the opportunity a few years ago to play a show in Zurich, which is a major European city on a beautiful, clean lake. And it's weird for an American to see, a lake that's on that's next to a giant city that people can drink the water and swim. And, it was mind blowing, and they had invested in the public space, mm-hmm. and they had a certain sense of pride. And I know Switzerland is not perfect, and there's a lot of sketchy banking stuff, but
unlike the States, of course, yeah. But we don't have any of that here, thank God.
But I mean, they've preserved something valuable for themselves, yeah. and they haven't left it up to corporations. They've said, this is ours, and we're going to take pride in stuff that's public. So I think a lot of what's happening with music is like we have to decide, you know, what's valuable and what we want to support and what we don't want to support, and architecture and the arts generally, we have to maybe grow up and see the that sustainability is a valuable thing.
Mm, yeah.
Next question.
Whatever you want, Sasha. It's your show.
No, it's yours. I think it's so important to have the conversation because you. So much of your book is conversations with artists.
Yeah.
And just allowing the creative people to be heard, and what is it that's agonizing about the situation you're in, and what are the kind of solutions that you're going to have. I want to say one thing about public space. Mm-hmm. We're in one right now.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, to not take full advantage of the libraries, because something you document beautifully throughout this is the crushing of places where people can meet and people can talk.
Right, right. Yeah, and one of the, you know, the example I use for those, I mean, I think libraries are hugely important, and a lot of my love of books and music came from libraries, and my wife is a librarian. I mean, it's an incredibly important thing to me. But what I write about in the book a lot that hasn't come up yet is bookstores and record stores and yeah. video shops, which are where, you know, people for decades have been, first of all, musicians, including John, I think, have been working at, you know, Tower Records on their way to becoming full-time musicians or full-time novelists. Jonathan Lethem did it in the Bay Area, Patti Smith, Lucinda Williams, all kinds of writers and Quentin Tarantino at a video store. There are also places where people like me, who will never be, you know, professional musicians, thank God, can go and meet people who are in love with this stuff. They're working around music or around books, whatever, because they just need to be near it, you know, and to go into those places and sort of inhale the atmosphere of them and the wisdom of the staffs and the clerks. I mean, that's something I've been doing my whole life, really, since I was a teenager. So to see those places start to collapse for economic reasons and because of online competition is heartbreaking to me. I mean, so many people who have taught me so much about culture are people who sold me books or records in a shop, and to see those shops evaporate one after another is really grim.
And there's something to be said for being in a physical space, because
yeah, absolutely.
This is being replaced by something online, but it's very sedentary,
right?
Disconnected from other human beings. Which
That's right.
And I think people like to be around other people once in a while. You know?
Yeah, some do. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's that great Michael Chabon book which came out a few years ago, Telegraph Avenue, about a sort of rare, you know, soul and R&B vinyl record store on the Oakland Berkeley border, and that captures it, captures the sort of spirit of a place like that so well.
Well, I just have to say that I think that it is entirely possible that these kinds of places will reemerge in a different way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the you know, let's just say the coffee shop again, Vienna, right. Habermasian example, whatever, that it isn't likely that people won't want to be around people. And the question
right,
is, where
true.
Do they get to do that? And are they, you know, does it have to be at the Grove, God forbid? I mean, not
right,
the
right,
Grove,
right.
Like, you know, like what do we have out there? And but you're what you're talking about again is commercial center. I mean, it's
yeah. I mean, you know, those places aren't literal public spaces, but they serve the kind of role that public spaces.
And that's, I guess, I would say, I think there is possibly a way that will come in a different way. I mean, I think this a little bit because of, let's just say, the culture of the Ace Hotels, which I have nothing to do with, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. I was in one recently, and you couldn't believe how many people were in the lobby.
It's funny.
I don't think most of them were staying there. I think most of them were staying there to go work on their computer, to hang out in the lobby. This was in London, whatever. But it was like ridiculous amount of people.
Yeah.
And it seemed like they just kept expanding the lobby because there were so many people coming there to, and they would buy a coffee or something. Like, it was, became a different thing.
I really admire your optimism, Barbara. I respect your judgment, obviously, and your investment in your commitment to spaces and making spaces work. And you're one of the best people in the business at doing that. It's funny that you mentioned the Ace Hotel, though. So when I go to Portland, I stay, I used to when I had a job, I would stay at the Ace Hotel because it was affordable, and I love the sort of old building, and the lobby is really cool. I love the coffee there. So because I'm doing an event here, and this is my first book, and it's kind of a big night for me because it took me years to write this thing, I thought I would like stay at the new Ace Hotel in downtown LA, and downtown LA has become this groovy neighborhood. And I thought, okay, I can spend like maybe a couple $100. It's, you know, big night for me. The Ace Hotel told me that they have a random Tuesday in January. They have a two-night minimum, and the room, the basic room that I wanted, is almost $500. So I don't say this. I love the Ace Hotel in Portland. I don't want to diss the whole company. I'm just saying that these public, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I just want to say that I could walk into, as a 16-year-old who heard that there was this interesting band from England called The Clash, or this really cool band called The Jam, or I could go to a bookstore and ask about Lorca's poetry. I could go into these places and not have to spend $950 to be part of the vibe. You know, I might want to buy a record once in a while, but these were places that regular middle-class folk could go. And I love the design at the Ace, and yeah, you could probably hang out in the lobby for a few minutes before they like drop-kicked you and asked you what room you were in. But I guess I think when big companies start to control everything, I don't know, it makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I understand that record stores and bookstores are commercial entities, but you talked about in-between spaces, which I think are super important for all kinds of culture, and I think that bookstores and record stores were in some way, and still are. I mean, a place like Skylight Books, you know, is a kind of in-between place. And in a funny way, and you know, kind of a newspaper is too, sort of a business, but a business that's committed to something besides money. And I guess that's kind of what I want to stand up for.
Well, there's a whole nother, I mean, there's maps of LA that describe public space as places where you can skateboard without getting caught.
Right,
you
know, like right, right,
the
right.
Campus at ELAC is a good one, apparently.
Right.
I mean, that would be sort of the interstitial space.
Yeah, segment,
Is generally like, yeah, like it's a bit outsiderish.
And you probably can't do it at Skylight Books, so I take your point.
it's a less heady intellectual atmosphere.
Right.
At the same time, there's a democratization.
I can't either. Yeah.
Democratization.
Yeah, there's a democratization that's happening. You know, when you can just download a song to your phone or stream lots of music for free, and it's not the same kind of human interaction, but it's a wondrous treasure chest of culture. Kind of unsustainable for artists, but really, really awesome, you know?
So the unsustainability is interesting because I think that, you know, there are arguments about, we talked about the possibility that entrepreneurship, a phase that we're in, is a phase, that it's an aesthetic phase, possibly no different than, this was Doug McLennan's idea, but we had to throw it out there, of, you know, just as going through feminism, going through multiculturalism, that people sort of opened up and said, okay, let's take certain things into account. And now I know, certainly as a teacher, I have to teach all of my students about branding and marketing, and they're journalists and they get the writing, and that's the most fundamental thing. But I cannot, in all good conscience, send them out into the world without them understanding how, for the first time, we talk about audience. You know, journalists never talked about audience. It would mean looking at all of you and saying, customers. You know, and this is the kind of headspace that I'm wondering, A, if you have if you've learned to do it too and had to. It is the democratization of the marketplace. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It's also maybe where we start swimming all together, you know? I don't know.
When do you guys take that?
Yeah, do you want to?
Well, I think there's that thing, which is, I'm sure you deal with this all the time, where, and it's obviously part of your trade, but that because of this kind of, let's say, social networking entrepreneurship that's almost a mandate, that you end up, people learn how to tell stories in a way that they didn't. Mm-hmm. Whether or not those stories are slightly more hackneyed than they might have been, had, were they sort of raw, and they're formatted, say, to the TED Talk format or the such and such form. But that storytelling thing is an interesting one, because it is a way that people end up connecting to more people. I think it's a little weird to go to like any given ad agency type of environment, and people are always talking about stories and stuff, and you're like, well, you guys aren't writing, like selling Purina or whatever. But it's kind of it's an interesting in that probably there's more people are learning how to write in general or communicate, perhaps, than they might have before. I mean, whether it's in the format of a tweet or a, you know, Salon article. But I think that's kind of an interesting, again, here I am, the Pollyanna person, but that storytelling thing is not, I think a lot of people never told a story in their life, you know. Mm. Whereas now you couldn't really be 25 and not know how to tell your story.
Hmm. There's a certain style to these stories, though, that I think, you know, that is... you know, like salesmanship in a way. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of, I mean, I don't know if a lot of authors, you know, I don't know, can, you know, who tend to be a little bit less gregarious, or would, you know, think of a lot of writers who you like, Thomas Pynchon or,
yeah,
you know,
something, yeah,
like that. Are they going to swim in this water very well? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, John makes an excellent point. I mean, I think Sasha's exactly right that I hadn't really thought of it this way, but you could say we went from sort of modernism to sort of the democratization of modernism in mid-century, then we went through sort of multicultural postmodernism, and now we're going through sort of the age of the self-promoting artist or the entrepreneur. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, there are good and bad things about each of these eras. But, yeah, I mean, if artists need to be basically busking all the time and promoting themselves and slapping backs and, you know, I don't want a culture that doesn't have a writer like Thomas Pynchon. One of my favorite jazz musicians was Eric Dolphy, who was an artist in L.A. in the 50s and early 60s, I guess, an incredibly dedicated, you know, abstract, you know, beautiful player who played with Mingus and some other people. And Eric Dolphy was not a self-promoter and never would have been. He would have just left, you know. He wouldn't have stayed in this. Elizabeth Bishop, the poet, she was not a backslapper. She wrote serene, you know, sort of lucid, you know, incredible. So if that's what you want, or if that's all that the sort of market will bear, you lose a certain kind of, especially introverted, you know, it's like that Susan Cain book, you know, Quiet or whatever. You lose like an entire portion of artistic expression for the sake of like Tony Robbins taking over, you know.
My
if you want to walk on hot coals all the time with Tony Robbins, then let's keep doing what we're doing. But we're losing a valuable kind of person.
End up with curators, I think. I mean, you end up with the people who are telling everybody, oh, you should listen to this, like whether they're doing the SMXU playlist or the, you know, the Guggenheim.
Well, human curators will always exist, but curators are increasingly apps and AI. I mean, human curators, meaning journalists, people who work in shops, are being sort of squeezed out. But
I mean,
I don't want to get ahead of the argument.
I'm grateful that we had a society that was willing to support non-performing songwriters like Harold Arlen, Irving Berlin,
right.
Cole Porter, people that
Gershwin
didn't perform their songs live and sell T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
But created a massive body of work that we all, probably everyone in this room, enjoys on a regular basis.
It's one of America's great contributions to world culture. Yeah, that Tin Pan Alley American Standards tradition is.
But we paid for it. Our grandparents paid those writers to sit in a room by themselves, mm-hmm. And not play around on Facebook all day. You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean that's the other point, which I think that's part of what Sasha may have been getting at. That if you know, and John, you know a lot of musicians and filmmakers talk about this. If you as an artist, as a filmmaker, as a musician or whatever, have to be running the Kickstarter campaign, on Facebook all the time, tweeting like a madman, you know, setting up your business model, or Taylor Swift has a fragrance now, you know, when do you get time to do the art? You know, wasn't that the whole point of this? And I talked to we're in LA, some of you might know the musician Stu from the band The Negro Problem, who's both he's a guy who has done what the internet, the Disruption Boys have told us all to do. He has reinvented himself, right? Stu is a sort of Silver Lake indie rock guy who kind of remade himself as a theater writer and performer and had a musical called Passing Strange that Spike Lee made into a movie. Stu tells me that he's avoided getting deep into this stuff because everybody in his building in Brooklyn is spending all their time self-promoting and they have no time to actually make their film or play their gig or write their songs. And he knows it's toxic, and at least for now he can hold it off. But the Stu that's, you know, 5 years younger, 10 years younger, that's coming along next is going to be swept into that. And then when does the soul enter into it? You know, when does the being alone and journeying and having experiences that you sort of refract into art, when does that come into it if you're spending all your time on the internet boasting about how great you are, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I hear from filmmaker friends of mine, and especially filmmakers who already are juggling about, you know, 10 or 12 balls in the air, to suddenly add a few more, like, oh, you know, gotta update my, you know, Facebook page and run my Kickstarter campaign. I mean,
and now you're your own manager too, right?
Yeah, right. So things are sort of contracting. So you don't have maybe the money to pay a manager anymore. So you are doing a lot more things, and so we get what we pay for. As a culture, I think we're going to get that. We're going to get that sort of somewhat diluted. You know, there's still going to be plenty of exciting music, and there's still going to be superstars. It's just that there's going to be a lot of stuff missing, in my opinion.
Do you think it's time for Chapter 8?
Yeah, sure, if you want. Yeah.
I thought...
You want to set it up?
I'll set it up a bit. Do you want me to give you my Chapter 8, or you're fine?
No, I've got one.
Okay. So Scott, in his book, the early one, he really starts, as you would say, initially with a rant.
Yeah.
Because of his very emotional circumstances of losing your job and losing your home and having a child and having a wife and what are you going to do? And then the chapters kind of roll out and look seriously at music, look seriously at architecture, and look at... what he's done is he's taken on many, many different art forms. And what I think, I mean, all of us find is no sooner have... There is no right answer or wrong answer. And every time you step towards something, there are other reasons why you want to go in another direction. And yet he's parsed this in a very... very smart, very journalism way through the stories of other people. And then you get to Chapter 8, and Chapter 8 is where he really does his social criticism and opens it up and says, okay, why? What happened? How did this happen? And I thought he should read it because it has ideas and because it shows you some of his writing skills and eloquence. And it's also kind of controversial.
Yeah, so this is the, I guess part of me thought people would just skip this chapter because, you know, this is the one that, like, everybody who knew me when I was young is going to think I was abducted by Martians and somehow sort of, or somebody held a gun to me. I mean, basically, you know, there's a term that journalists use, investigative reporters, where they say that, you know, they're just going to follow the story. You know, they heard maybe that some politician might be mobbed up and might not be. They're just going to sort of follow the story and see where it leads them, and it might get complicated. It might be nothing. You know, the kind of Watergate-era thing for this was follow the money, right? That was the Woodward and Bernstein thing. They would just sort of follow the money and see where it led. Did it lead to the president or where it goes? So for this book, I treat it in some ways like a murder mystery or something, where I knew something had happened. A lot of us had been wiped out or sort of wounded. And I had a feeling there was this really complicated set of layered, you know, kind of explanations that I couldn't quite see how they fit together. So I just asked a lot of questions and thought a lot and read a ton of books and tried to. So I ended up a place where I wouldn't have expected. So I'll just read you a little bit of it. And again, this is where all of my college professors who hear this throw the book across the shelf and pretend they never knew me. So here's how it begins. So I say, how did we get to a place where Pomona College, an elite California school that over the past decade included David Foster Wallace and Jonathan Lethem among its faculty, graduated only 16 English majors in 2013, where the alternately prestigious and infamous Yale English department sees a drop of more than 60% from graduating majors two decades ago. Even post-crash, Princeton now sends nearly 40% of those who graduate with a job directly to Wall Street. F. Scott Fitzgerald's alma mater, as well as Stanford, has begun a kind of affirmative action program to seek out high school students dedicated to studying the humanities. This is a quote. In response, a number of defenses have been mounted, none of them so far terribly persuasive, even to one rooting for them to persuade, Adam Gopnik wrote in The New Yorker. As the bromides roll by and the platitudes chase each other around the page, those in favor of ever more and better English majors feel a bit the way we Jets fans feel every fall when our offense trots out on the field. I'm cheering as loud as I can, but let's be honest, this is not working well. That's Gopnik. So all of these issues exert an effect on the creative class. This tale would seem very different if we told it in 1985 or 1999. But here's how it all looks from the second decade of the 21st century. Here's how we got the culture of culture we have now, and why it's so hard to get out of the ditch we seem to be in. And here's what's unpleasant to realize. In some ways, demonstrating the law of unintended consequences, members of the creative class created this mess by themselves. So I try to argue that in this chapter. I want to make clear, I think there are some, some of the art establishment, culture establishment made mistakes. I just want to be clear that the wounding of the creative class that we're here to talk about has primarily been done by technology, by plutocracy, by the very rich, and by laws and customs that were established by other people, not by artists and writers and scholars and so on. But again, there were some unexpected and perhaps unintended ways in which we pulled the rug out from culture in the long run, and that's kind of that's one of the things we're dealing with in the 21st century. I guess that's the most succinct I can make it.
We are going to move to questions in 1 minute, 2 minutes. So be thinking about that and rolling around in your head what it is that you'd like to talk about. I just want to kind of wrap up here with important things, because you found the body in the pool.
Yeah, it turned out it was me. Just kidding. Why don't we kick it to them for a second? I'd like to hear from John or Barbara for a second before I depress you guys further.
I guess I could reiterate that I think there is a way out. I think we need to take pride in public things, take pride in public space. I think there needs to be a nonprofit music and culture distribution platform that is...
You can clap for that if you're interested in it.
And sign up for it, too.
Yeah, right.
In addition to that, creators need a collective representation. We need to be in there as copyright law is being rewritten right now. We need to... Currently, we don't have really a voice, our own voice, weighing in on the subject. And copyright law is generally rewritten every 30 or 40 years. So however it comes down, it's going to be a big deal. And we need to hurry up and get a collective voice for ourselves. So that's why we've been working on creating an organization, a nonprofit called the Content Creators Coalition. And I urge you to Google us, our audience. If you are somebody that makes cartoons or photographs or films or music, it's not really about being anti-Spotify or anti-Google. It's what's going to happen to us 5 years from now if we have no collective voice. So I urge you to look into that if you're interested. That's the most important thing I can say.
Yay.
Okay. So I think this is we're looking for solutions. So I'll say, first of all, the crisis I write about is sort of centuries in the making, and especially the economic side of this. In other words, how are we at a place where, six members of the Walton family or something has as much wealth as the lower 40% of the U.S. I mean, the big economic shifts that have taken capital from the middle class and shifted them to the top 1% of the 1% is something that, my book will not single-handedly redo that. But
the movement to restore the creative class needs to be parallel and in tandem with the movement that restores the middle class. We, in the creative class, mostly exist within the middle class. When that group gets crushed, we pay the price for it too. There's this whole myth that artists, I think John talked about this a little bit, that artists are either these sort of heroic, you know, super famous people, or they're sort of passed out in the gutter. Most artists, I mean visual artists, I also mean musicians, I also mean people who operate in this economy, even architects, are part of the middle class, and they are vulnerable to all of the ravages that have slammed the middle class over the past few decades. So that's a major, major thing. It's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but if you care about this stuff, you need to care about the fate of the middle class as well. Each of the genres I write about, you know, music, architect books, blah, 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 journalism, has its own kind of cause and effect and trajectories. I do think, I mean, people are going to hate me for this, but I think that if we are going to have serious journalism in this country, the old model, which was built on corporate ownership and print advertising, is broken. Journalism needs to be supported by some public funds, not a lot, but some. You look at radio. Tell me a radio station, a commercial radio station, that's half as good as something like KCRW, where I was the other day, or KPFK, where I was today. Public funding and admittedly membership drive and that sort of thing have saved radio, which had become a smoking ruin in a lot of cases. Some of the same ravages, I mean, have hit, you know, I probably don't need to tell you what's happened to the LA Times, or, you know, I was brought out to LA 17, 18 years ago to work for a weekly that doesn't even exist. The paper I came out to work for, New Times LA, had destroyed two previous weeklies. So you basically have like the rubble of three weeklies, you know, gone in this city. The LA Times has half the staff of what it had when I came in 12 years ago or whenever it was. So the paper, you know, just so I know a lot of people will say, oh, Jesus, if the government is supporting, you know, this guy wants Pravda, you know, if the government is supporting, you know, the press, you just want it to be a house organ for the state or something. It's absolutely not what I'm saying. The feistiest major newspaper in the Western world is The Guardian, which is run by a nonprofit trust. It is not a for-profit institution, and it has been the toughest on the US and the British government on this surveillance nonsense. They have the ability, and I don't mean it's easy for them, because they struggle all the time to make it work, but the profit model has not given us the most fiercely independent and feistiest paper. It's a nonprofit model. So we need to double down on that if we care about democracy. the last thing I'll just to be clear, when I talk about, you know, publications need some public support and the arts need more public support, you know, we're talking about basically pocket change, given, you know, what, say, our military budget or our surveillance budget is. We have a military that's as big as the next 10 countries in the world put together. So I think we can probably spare a little pocket lint to make democracy and culture work better. That's like one drone strike I'm talking about to support all this stuff. The other thing I'll say to close out is just, it's more abstract. I get into it in my conclusion. It's hard to explain it completely, but I'll just put it this way. There was, you know, in the sort of the Romantic era, that the modern era of modernism, there was what they used to call culture worship. There was this sense that, you know, you see it, say, in James Joyce's novels. You see it in the way that museums and theaters were built to look like temples and churches. There was a sense that culture, whether it was art or poetry or music or whatever, was sort of a door into the soul, right? These were sort of opportunities for transcendence. And in the mid-century, this stuff was spread around, rising literacy rates, you know, book clubs run by Lionel Trilling and that kind of thing. There was a spreading of sort of the sort of heavy, serious, you know, modernist works. Back then, we called it culture. Now, I do it too, and it's the name of John's group. I'm not pointing fingers. Now we all talk about it as content. So what the hell happened, you know, that like that a great novel or a great symphony or a great rock song or a great modernist building, you know, a John Lautner building that Barbara might work on, that this stuff has gone from being culture to being content. You know, if something, it's not just technology that changed. Something happened to our souls. You know, we sort of gave up on the fact that this stuff mattered, and we started to worship money and status and this other sort of nonsense. So if we're going to save the creative class and if we're going to sort of regain our values, I say this, I'm not a religious guy. I'm a lifetime agnostic. But if we're going to regain sort of our values as a society, we're going to start thinking of this stuff in another way. It may not be exactly the way we thought about it before, but we're going to retain, we're going to restore some of the sort of little bit, at least, of the sacred aura to music, to literature, to architecture, and to the people who make it. If we don't do that, it's all over. I hope you care as much as I do about this stuff.
Yay. Thank you. With that, we'll take questions, one or two or three. And there are microphones, I believe, handed around.
First question right over here?
Oh. Sure.
Hello. Thank you, everyone, for your lovely thoughts. I wanted to ask about, I'm from Europe originally. I'm from Poland. Mm. I was born during socialism. And I'm also slightly younger than all of you, not by much.
Don't rub it in.
And I'm also a designer and artist working in this economy. And, you know, you were talking about Switzerland, you were talking about the lake, and in my experience, Europe, most of Western Europe, has always been extremely supportive of culture. There's always extra funding for it because it's considered... value, social value, such as health. And, you know, as a younger generation, and in the way you were talking about organizing, you know, we in this country are the government, right? That's what they always say. And
wouldn't it be nice to think so?
I actually would like to think so. And I think this is the moment to think so. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we don't have enough time to. For
I guess my question is how what suggestions you would have for the younger generation in order to organize to influence its own government to have more support for culture and consider it of a social value.
You want to take that, John, since you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. I think that maybe we could put less emphasis on fetishizing individuality and outsider status, mm-hmm. and think more about you know, survival and sustainability and you know, and quality of life, things like it, for a community, as opposed to always about the individual. Individuality is great, but I think it's been used by a consumeristic imperative, and it's time to say what the hell's going on, and and let's invest in ourselves, and let's have a little bit of self-respect for change.
And that's exactly right. I'll just add, you know, you asked about younger people. I think that, you know, I gave my best shot at trying to figure out our way out of this crisis. I think that young people, perhaps like you, especially who have a sort of global perspective, will be the ones to figure our way out of this and to help solve this problem. At least I hope so.
Yeah.
So I heard from her that you did research into like many, many centuries of the arts. I'm wondering if you read or discovered previous accounts of the arts classes crashing and rebounding. And if so, if you can tell them briefly, like what were the circumstances that caused the crash and the rebound? Because we'll get ideas for the rebound from
how they did it before. Yeah, that's a good question. I guess the most succinct way I could put it is that, you know, the moments of art for art's sake where, you know, we've sort of respected this stuff, you know, are pretty brief. The heydays for artists in the creative class are, you know, even during Shakespeare's period, which is a great cultural flowering, for instance, Queen Elizabeth and her government were suspicious of the actors and used to spy on them because she thought they were sort of starting rebellions in there. So the main thing I learned with respect to that is, I mean, first of all, I think what we're going through with the internet, you know, is it the worst thing, the second worst thing? You know, it's really hard to tell. Is it worse than the coming of industry to Britain, which put thousands of craftsmen out of work? You know, the technological shift we're going through now is really hard to find earlier parallels for. The thing I'll say that that I think will reflect John and Barbara's experience is that artists and creative types have been sort of the collateral damage for a lot of other fights that we didn't really have anything to do with. I mean, if you look at, say, the Protestant Reformation, it just wiped out the livelihoods of tons of musicians because the Catholics had choral singing and all kinds of things that the Puritans, for instance, weren't interested in. The culture wars of the 80s and early 90s, which weren't exactly about art. They were about politics. They were about Newt Gingrich and Dan Quayle and sort of angry Republicans trying to scapegoat artists. Artists got sort of drawn in and discredited and sort of baited and so on. But it really wasn't about the artists. They were just sort of convenient. John talks about artists being used as human shields by the record labels with the tech with these technological changes. So I guess the thing I've found is that artists are often sort of accidental, sort of innocent bystanders who get ground up in sort of larger fights. That was one of the main lessons I learned for looking back in history.
Next question. Thank you.
What can we do to get young people interested in art, and how can we encourage creativity in art people today?
Very important question, Barbara. You want to take that? You know some young people, I think.
Well, I don't think it's that hard to get.
Some of them are your children.
I do have a couple. Thank you. I think that there's creativity isn't necessarily isn't a scarce resource at all. I think that that's actually the question is how do you find ways to help it bloom, you know? And I think that probably, and this is maybe me more as a parent and to some extent as an educator, education seems to be the biggest issue that the LAUSD lack of funding for arts right now is really at an all-time low. Yeah. So,
though, interestingly, LAUSD did find, what was it, $1.1 billion to give tablets to every student. So it's not like they're out of money. They just don't really think the stuff that we value, like librarians, libraries, music education, art education, they don't think that matters, but they think high-tech stuff does.
I would say that having recently done a little sort of education touring, I think that kids who are going to private school in the U.S. right now are getting plenty of arts education, and that kids who are going to public school are probably not getting a heck of a lot, and that is really becoming more of an economic disparity, that it's not so much the lack of creativity, but the lack of channels to practice it and sort of sharpen your skills. Because as I think we all know that you to get to a certain level, it actually is a lot about putting in the time and the work and building up the skill set. It isn't the struck by lightning one day, like, you're a fifth symphony, whatever. So that kind of, I think that would be my biggest.
Next question? Yes.
For Scott Timberg. You said that the culture class pulled the rug out from under themselves, but I didn't hear you say how that happened. Could you?
Right. I guess in a nutshell, I'll just do it. It's chapter 8. Basically, it comes back to what I said a minute ago about the idea of culture as something sacred. I mean, this was something that was a bedrock idea of modernism. Again, if you look at, say, the James Joyce book, like, say, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, it's a journey, obviously. If you look in the German Bildungsroman, you see the whole thing, too. It was a central idea to sort of post-Nietzschean life in the West. So then in the 60s and 70s, you started getting people like Andy Warhol who said, well, art is just really a name, or it's sort of about personality, or art is really about power because it's about who gets to be in the museum or not. And you had French scholars, Jacques Derrida, Foucault, et cetera, the post-structuralist, who said that literature isn't a door into wisdom. Literature is this endlessly deferred signifier. You know, it's all just sort of codes and signs. You had a whole intellectual movement called postmodernism that said that art didn't have any connection to the soul. And then 20 years later, people stop studying the humanities and start going right to Wall Street. I don't think it's a simple cause and effect, but I think there's no question that the sacred quality of art was undercut by people who thought they were doing interesting and original things. They ended up gutting the sense that the arts were worth fighting for and that they had some kind of deep and real meaning.
I don't totally agree with this because I also come from similar backgrounds in terms of the importance of critical theory at a certain point. And I do think that like in my profession, for instance, criticality itself which came out of that movement has already moved on, and there's other kind of
sure, absolutely, like but the damage has been done. Unintended consequences, I think.
But the backstory might be more like, say, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. Like, it might be more an issue of modernism, I think, than it is necessarily, you know, postmodernism. But that's
right. We'll arm wrestle with this over wine after this, but that's kind of what I mean. Yeah,
we should have wine after this, and this the good thing.
Or hemlock.
what you also said though is that English teachers didn't defend what they were teaching.
Right.
Peter Plagans, who's an art critic, would say, you know, nobody knows how to draw anymore. Like, so the arts teachers actually didn't teach anatomical, you know, how to draw something anatomically
technique and
correct.
Craft
they didn't teach
out,
technique. Yeah. Everybody threw it out. And so there's been sort of a throwing out that he's saying the creative class, those teachers of it dismantled their own, pulled the rug out. I think that's what you
Yeah,
said.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We do need to carry on into the wider room where there's wine or what is it? It's a...
And possibly books as well,
bar or something, which could be very good. I hope this has ignited serious conversation and ideas. I really hope that you will buy Scott's book and support him. It is.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.